One of my favorite ones is number 17 on page 123. Vayur anilamamritam atedam bashmantam shariram om kratos smarakritam smara kratos smarakritam smara. Partly I just like the way that the verse sounds. And then also it's a sort of a startling verse. It's not something you hear every day in the general conversations. Let this temporary body be burned to ashes. That's kind of shocking. And even if any of you have ever been to a cremation, in America you go to a cremation and you don't get to see the body being burned, actually. I went to one recently for my mother, and there's just a gigantic oven, really, that gets really hot. It's very technical and clinical and everything. Huh? Yeah, I shouldn't use the word oven. But it is, nonetheless. And you know, they put the body in, and then it's immolated. Is it immolated, or do you have to immolate yourself? Could you look it up? And anyway, the body's burned. You really don't see it happen. You know, just see the temperature going up higher and higher. But in India, the way they burn bodies, and maybe some other countries, you actually get to go to the burning ghat. I've been to a couple of burning ghats. One in Vrindavan, once I was there, and a devotee who had come there to die died in the middle of the night. So in the next morning, right after Mangal Arati, we took her on a palanquin to all the temples around Vrindavan for a last parikram, and then we all went to the bank of the Jamuna. And there was already prepared a pyre with gigantic logs and then, of course, tinder underneath. And they placed the body of this devotee, a female devotee from Germany, on the pyre, and then they lit it on fire. And it's a revelation to watch the body burn, because I had a reaction, a visceral reaction, when I was watching that I felt, oh no, wait a minute, you can't do that, because I'm so used to identifying the body with the self, and seeing that the body is being burned is a shocking thing. So the first statement of this verse, let this temporary body be burned to ashes. I mean, it's saying, let this body be burned to ashes, and you know, who goes around saying that, let alone thinking about it? Mostly, there is, I would say, I'm attempting to avoid death, find a comfortable position, and avoid any kind of suffering. What to say if, like, okay, burn this body, let it be burned to ashes. But this is a kind of meditation that Lord Shiva does constantly. Where does he live, Lord Shiva? Crematorium. He hangs out in crematoriums, and what does he put on his body as an ornament? Puts ashes. You know, he's a renunciate. He doesn't wear any clothes generally. He lives under, you know, a tree and stays in the crematoriums, and he puts ashes on his body, and he has skulls around. You know, it's a reminder. Body is a temporary thing. It's going to go away very quickly. Tendency is for materialistic life is to invest everything in the body, which is what we call a waste of time. And all the Shastras say it's a waste of time to simply invest in the body. Where is it said in the Shastra that the body is it's a waste of time simply to take care of the body? Who can say? What? Yes. Yeah. Hmm. Good point. And where's that said in Shastra? There is a verse that says that. There's verses that say that if you simply take care of the body, in other words, there's a verse in the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita that says, if you live only for the senses, the body's made of senses, then you live only in vain. There's also a verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam that says, in essence, it says, Kamasya nendriya pritir labo jiveta yavata. Jivasya tattva jignasya narto yash cheha karmabhi. So I'll give a modern-day translation saying, eat to live, don't live to eat. So there is the idea in this verse, jivasya tattva jignasya, you should live a healthy life, a balanced life. Why? Because the body is extremely valuable. Nri deham ajam su labam sudurlabam. It's said in the Shastras, labam sudurlabam idam bahusambhavanti, that this is the most valuable vessel you could possibly have found yourself in. and therefore it should be taken care of like a temple. And for the purpose, as Srila Prabhupada used to say, keeping body, soul, and the body and the soul together. For what purpose? Jivasya tattva jignasa. You should stay alive just so you can go on with your spiritual practice, basically. And not, you know, there's a sense of balance there, which I'm glad you brought that out. So what's the verse from the Bhagavad Gita that says you live in vain if you live only for sense gratification? It's okay to look, too. And you can look in the index or whatever it takes. What does immolate means? You can immolate someone else. It means... It doesn't necessarily mean burning, right? Oh, okay. Everyone learned a new word tonight. I mean, I did anyway. Immolate. Okay. Destroy, kill. In sacrifice. But some people do for political reasons that immolate themselves. There may be other verses too that you think of, but Okay, page 163. And what's described before this is that there's a way of living by performing sacrifice, yajna. That human life is especially meant to perform yajna. And then, this verse, evam pravartitam chakram nanu vartaya tihaya agayur indriya ramo mogam parta sajivati. My dear Arjuna, one who does not follow in human life the cycle of sacrifice thus established by the Vedas certainly leads a life full of sin. Living only for the satisfaction of the senses, such a person lives only in vain. So, this verse we're talking about in the Sri Upanishad says, let this temporary body be burned to ashes. And I was saying that at the crematorium, my experience watching for the first time a body actually being burned was an effect which is mentioned also in Shastra. It's called Shmashan Vairagya. Vairagya, of course, means some detachment from the world, a healthy sense of detachment. And smashan means ashes. So it's the detachment that I might get from visiting the crematorium and watching a body burn, being burned, and then realizing I'm not the body, and this is the end of this body also, that you know, very soon it will be burned. So there's a certain kind of vairagya. And this is called smashan vairagya, and generally it's temporary, because although I may feel detached when I walk away from that scene, gradually, my mind and my senses, which are accustomed to convince me that actually I can stay here permanently and be happy in this world, make it the best of me. Just like in Krishna's pastimes, he fought with Jarasandha how many times? 17 times? You know that Krishna erected a fort in Dwarka, and Jarasandha came to fight with him. And each time that Jarasandha came to fight, the first time chariots appeared out of outer space for Krishna and Balaram, fully equipped with all kinds of weapons. And there was a huge sea of soldiers on the side of Jarasandha that came to fight. And from the fighting of Krishna and Balaram, they destroyed all of those soldiers. And there were rivers of blood actually flowing from that. However, after being completely defeated by Krishna, Jarasandha walked away depressed, and he thought that he would give up his position as a kshatriya, as a king, and go off and simply live by himself in obscurity in some village somewhere. But when some of his ministers caught up with him, they told him, no, it was a fluke. You actually could have won. You just... You know, he caught you on a bad day. That's all. You know, it was total devastation from it. And that happened to him over and over again. And I was thinking, it's, you know, typically the the score, Maya against the Jiva in the material world, is trillions and trillions to zero. Maya's winning. But somehow there's a way that I get convinced over and over again that, no, it's okay, it was a fluke. You can actually enjoy. Just go back and try again. You just didn't try. Happened. It just wasn't the right kind of situation or something like that. So Smashan Vairagya, I might for a few days feel a little bit of detachment, but then it kind of comes back in and I develop it. Krishna told Uddhava in his teachings that he should observe the world for himself in several different ways. He said, Shruti Pratyakshamaityam Anumanam Chatushtayam Pramani Swanavastana Vikalpatsa Virajite. He told him to be very observant of the world. And first he said, hear from Shruti that this world is temporary. And then he said, learn from your own experience. Pratyaksha, see for yourself that it's temporary. Then also through logical deduction, understand that it's a temporary situation. And also, he said, through teachings that are passed down through word of mouth, like cultural kind of stories and things like that, understand that it's a temporary place, and therefore develop a sense of detachment from the world. So this verse engenders a sense of detachment just from the first words, let this temporary body be burnt to ashes, because it reminds me that at any time my body can be burnt to ashes. And, it could be today or tomorrow or next week, I don't know. But that's the end of the body. And of course, in the very beginning of his teachings to Arjuna, Krishna said, Dehi nosmin yata dehe komaranyabhanam jara tata dehantara praptir dhiras tatra namuyati. He told Arjuna that this body changes. You're the person inside the body, you're the dehi, person occupying the body, and that the body's going to change from boyhood to youth to old age, and that you should become dhira, which means steady, undisturbed by all the changes. Then he said, matra sparsha stukonteya shitoshna sukatukada Agama paino nityas tamsta tikshashvabharata. He advised Arjuna that all kinds of changes are going to come to the body, hot, cold, fame, infamy. Sometimes you're well, sometimes you're sick. But he said that you'll have to learn to tolerate these things, be titiksha, which means tolerant. This is a very basic teaching of spiritual life. When you're traveling, you have to tolerate a lot of things. You know, just getting ready to travel, you have to plan in so many ways and tolerate, the mind's rejection of leaving your comfort zone and then make so many arrangements to travel. When you travel, there are all kinds. I always say, when you're at home, you get what you want. When you're traveling, you get what you get. So you have to travel. That's why a lot of renunciates travel. Is because you develop a sense of detachment by seeing how, first of all, wherever you go, Krishna supplies for you. Anybody here ever missed a meal in your life when it wasn't voluntary, like fasting or something? Did you ever miss a meal, Dainini? Anybody else miss a meal ever? Yeah? Because of poverty? Yeah? Because you couldn't get anything to eat? You were starving, your family was hungry, no money? Because you didn't go out to get it or something like that? That's a little different. The Lord's filled up the universe with food. This is an interesting thing. It's mentioned in the Mahabharata that the Lord has filled up the universe with food and wealth and money and all kinds of things. But each individual can only get according to what's your karma, what's your destiny. But my main point was that, if you travel, you can see also, or even if you don't travel, you can observe and see that actually Krishna's providing all kinds of things. Therefore, in the Bhagavad Gita, he recommends yadrishcha labha santushto, learn to be satisfied with things which come of their own accord. They come naturally. And don't over-endeavor for all kinds of ideas which of trying to adjust so that you'll be completely happy. There's a lot of ways that we can tolerate things. So anyway, I'm talking a lot about vairagya and detachment and things like that because this verse brings that out. Let this temporary body be burnt to ashes and let the air of life be merged with the totality of air. Now, O my Lord, please remember all my sacrifices, and because you are the ultimate beneficiary, please remember all that I've done for you. There's a sense here that of course, throughout the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna talks about how Ishvara sarvabhutanam hridaye sharjuna tishtati ramayan sarvabhutani yantra rudrani mayaya. He says that I'm with you in every species of life and everywhere you go, everywhere you travel, Krishna always stays with us. He's so compassionate, so friendly to the soul, that even when I take the form of a hog, and it's just basically wasting time and as a hog. Nothing against hogs as a class, but they are wasting time. He goes there also and is observing and helping the soul who's in that situation. So Krishna's always there, and he's the ultimate beneficiary. Everything's coming from him. Pitaham asya jagato mata data pitamaha. He says in the ninth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita that I'm the father and I'm the mother of everyone. And so he's like that. He's supplying for us. So knowing that, yes, please. You could use the microphone. Use the mic.
How do you explain all the famine and there's so many people dying because they don't have any food? So how would you explain that?
Well, according to what one deserves, then the Lord supplies. There's according to karma, which means that there's a continuum in our lives. Like, why do bad things happen to good people? Apparently, it may seem arbitrary, but if we're able to see the continuum of why there's a reaction to coming to somebody who apparently in this life seems to be a peaceful, good person, and all of a sudden there's an aberration, something happens, it's due to some past reaction that's coming. So I may get a reaction from the past. And according to the laws of karma, Krishna talks about this in the Bhagavad Gita, those who perform pious works, means there are certain kinds of things where you help others or you give charity, then in your next life or in future lives, then you're also supplied with wealth and charity. Not only is it, you know, on the side of penury or poverty, where somebody is getting the result of their karma, but also on the side of someone who's wealthy without trying for it. Or naturally, certain things come because of past karma and continuum. And Prabhupada noticed this once in Calcutta when he was on a morning walk. There was a project the government had to get a lot of the poor people off the street. And they built them these dwellings that had some of the indoor plumbing and stuff like that. And one of the devotees was pointing out to Prabhupada that most of the people who had gone to those that was being subsidized by the government had come back to live on the street, and then they rented them out to other people so they could go and live in those places. But Prabhupada was just saying, you know, is there karma to live on the street? So they ended up staying there. And he said, similarly, he was talking to Americans at the time who were on the walk with him. He said, you have karma as Americans. He said, you come to India and you live the same lifestyle as an American when you come to India. So you take your karma wherever you go with you. And clearly, there's a continuum. And carried over from our past life, I may be put in a situation where I have less or I have more according to my karma. Yes. Please take the microphone, because there's devotees in the back and they're listening also to the conversation. It's not on.
Okay. How would karma be justified from a life, any life that you, for instance, don't understand where it's coming from? How is it justified, or how can you? I mean, I almost feel like it's not really fair if some sort of karma comes to you. You feel like you're a good person. You feel like you're doing well. You're doing the best you can do, and then it comes out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Something like a bomb hits, and like someone's life's just completely, you know, their car is taken away, something, their house, whatever. It's just coming out of nowhere, and to understand that, it's one thing. I mean, on one level, okay, well, this is karma, but it doesn't really. For me, it doesn't really explain how, you know.
Well, let me ask you, how do you feel when something comes out of left field, like some disaster comes? Maybe you haven't had that happen, but what if something happens, you're put in a precarious situation, how do you feel suddenly?
Well, how do I feel?
It's your reaction.
I don't feel it's a reaction.
No. I'd say, what is your reaction?
My reaction. I don't. Of course, I feel very uncomfortable. Very.
Anything else?
I think ultimately it's supposed to help you get closer to Krishna.
No, I'm just asking from a practical point of view. How do you feel? Like, because I know for myself, certain things have happened in my life. And how I react to them.
Mm-hmm.
You feel a victim? You feel victimized? Any other reaction? Something like catastrophic happens? Grief? Anger? Anybody else?
Sadness?
Does it just stay in one level? Did you? Destiny? Okay.
A lot of anger?
Anger, yeah.
Okay, yes. Why me? So a lot of questioning, things like that. We've seen also, besides our own experience, we see sometimes disasters happen to other people. Some of the most philosophical conversations take place after world disasters. I think after the big tsunami, was it Indonesia, right? There was a spate of interviews, conversations with all kinds of religious leaders on, who knows, all kinds of levels, people asking these questions about why did this happen, right? Other reaction, which I've trying to adduce, which was that oftentimes people feel a sense of helplessness. And then there's an old saying, of course, there's no atheists in foxholes. But generally, it's come to this point where there's a way in which when there's some kind of a disaster or something happens which is way beyond our control, sometimes people turn to God, even when they weren't thinking about it before. In other words, Queen Kunti talks about this in her prayers. She says, Janmaishraya Shruta Shribir Edamana Madapuman Naivarhat Yadidatum Vai Tvama Kinshana Gocharam. In essence, she says, when we're well situated in the material world, when things are happy, when we have wealth, when we have our beauty is there, we have some fame or something like that, then generally I don't think about God. You know, I have a full, I think someone else coming in, but you can close. There's, I have a full bank account and a new car and everything's okay. I'm leaning and I'm driving and I'm thinking, you know, everything's fine, right? But when there's some disaster, Queen Kunti said, then I'm okay. But when something happens all of a sudden, then there's a tendency for me to think, oh no, I'm out of control. I need to take shelter. So, you know, one thing is, yes, please go ahead. Yes, very true. This is... Yeah. Exactly. And this Krishna talks about this in the Bhagavad Gita. So he says there's different kinds of reactions based on one's sukriti. And now, so he says, Chaturvida bhajante mam jana sukritino arjuna arto jignasa artarti gyanicha bhadartarshapa. He said, four kinds of men approach me. Four kinds of pious people approach me. Desirous of wealth, somebody who's inquisitive, someone who's in distress, and somebody who's in knowledge of the absolute. These kinds of four kinds of people approach. Then he mentions another class of people. Namam duskritinumada prapadyante naradama maya aprita jnana asuram bhavamasrita. So he names this duskritina. And duskritina is the opposite of sukritina, which is mentioned in the next verse. In other words, people might have some ability or expertise, but they use it for bad things. Or, you know, it's demented. Anyway, I won't go through those four categories of people who are devoid of sukriti, but I will mention the four that do have it, and that they all approach God, and some of them are distressed, some of them need money, but they have some piety, some basis, some sukriti, which is the most valuable asset that one can gain. And Krishna talks about this in the 16th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, and he calls it Daivi Sampat. It's actually the real wealth of the living entity. As Srila Prabhupada described it, it's like every living being has a bank account in their heart. And when they come in contact with devotees and devotional service, they're able to make a contribution to that bank account. When there's a sufficient balance, there's Shraddha is born. It comes out naturally. Ado Shraddha, why some people naturally turn towards Krishna. So, in the case of distress of people losing their money, those who have some sukriti, they'll turn to God. And they'll say, okay, you know, please help me. So those who don't have that, they tend to become bitter, accusatory, and, you know, discount the fact that there's any God. This is all random. If there is a God, why would this happen? And so on and so forth. But in general, a devotee who's developing in devotional service, to the extreme case, is the verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Tatenu Kampam Susamikshamanu Bhunjane Vatmakritam Vipakam, that an actually very advanced devotee feels that everything that's coming to me now is a result of what I've done. And that's not just devotees, actually. That's mature people. Because if you look in the self-help movement, for instance, anybody knows Brian Tracy? He's a big speaker, speaks about self-help. You know Brian Tracy? He's well-known in the speaking circuit and, you know, speaks about topics of, like, how to help yourself and, you know, self-help. So I guess that's why they call it that. But one of his main, you know, sutras of his teaching is that whatever we have now in our life is what we deserve. It's what we ourselves have brought upon ourselves according to our past activities. We've brought it to ourselves. This is a very mature way of thinking, actually, that, you know, whatever comes to me is something that I've brought upon myself. Now, thinking about it in terms of this life is a lot easier. But if something comes out of left field, then it's a little more cosmic, you know, to think like, well, hey, I was good. I've been doing good deeds, and all of a sudden I got crushed, you know. But that requires sukriti to be able to understand that. So now there's a question of why is this arrangement there that, you know, certain people are getting slapped around by material nature, but they're ignorant, and they don't know why. And therefore, it seems a little bit odd because, you know, like if you're training a puppy or something, you know, and if you don't tell him why he's being punished, there's a disconnect. He doesn't really get it. And that's why it's so important to have knowledge. And we started by talking about this at the beginning of class, that ignorance is the cause of all suffering. And anarto pasanam sakshad bhakti yoga madhoksajay lokasya ajanato vidvams chakri safata samhitam. Krishna knows this. The sages know it. The devotees know it. And therefore they distribute knowledge because people have to know. And beyond even knowing, there's a way in which they have to get sukriti, somehow a connection with devotional service, because then they can solve the problems of life. Otherwise, I can take the stance that it's me against material nature, and all I have to do is try a little bit harder in the field of science to come up with a fix for disease. And how well does that work? Well, let's look. I mean, we thought that we wiped out TB in 1965 or something like that. We declared victory, and it came out to be about as effective as George Bush's, please don't mind, victory speech on the aircraft carrier that we won in Iraq. Because TB, although it was greatly diminished, is on the rise again. I just saw it in an in-flight magazine that it's, I think it was something like that, that it's coming back. You can't eradicate TB. But, I mean, if you want to talk about diseases, you could go down through the alphabet and name me a disease that starts with an A. Anything else? Anything else? Yes, anything else? Huh? What's that one? Asperger's, yes. Anything else? Allergies? We go on all night just with the A's. How about B's? Anything on B? Huh? Bulimia. Okay, B is bulimia. What else? Botulism? Hey. What else under B? Okay, C, cancer. That covers a lot. It's all kind of, anyway, you go down the whole alphabet, and I guarantee if we had a medical encyclopedia, we'd be here all night. The adjustment to fix the problems of material life isn't possible from a material standpoint. Therefore, the beginning teaching from the Bhagavad Gita is that you're not your body. Life is temporary thing, but it's meant for spiritual advancement, not for an adjustment, because we've tried that. It's been tried, and it's not looking promising. Yes. Can you use a microphone?
Two verses that was relevant to the discussion of the body, and I'm now trying to locate where that is, where probably it was the Srimad Bhagavatam.
The one I quoted earlier?
Yeah, where it said that...
Tamasya nindriya pritir.
Yes, life's desire should never be directed towards sense gratification. One should desire only a healthy life or self-preservation, since a human being is meant for inquiry about the absolute truth.
But did you get the first canto now?
So it does stress that there is a need to maintain a healthy life.
Yeah.
And in order to do that, one would have to have develop healthy habits, eat healthy food, all those things that would go with it. And so one would have to therefore pay attention to that part of leading a healthy life as opposed to an unhealthy one.
Yes, absolutely. Of course, there's the Ayurveda. It's part of the Vedic system, and recommendations for living a healthy life. Living in the mode of goodness generally is a healthy life. You know, bathing several times a day, eating food which is not contaminated, and so on and so forth. You know, all these habits naturally come about in a Krishna conscious lifestyle. And as we talked about this verse before, you know, one does have to maintain the body in order to inquire and to go on with spiritual life. So it's a balanced life, no question about it. What number is the verse? Kamasin, it's number 10. I'll read the purport. First, the translation. Life's desire should never be directed towards sense gratification. One should desire only a healthy life, or self-preservation. Since a human being is meant for inquiry about the absolute truth, nothing else should be the goal of one's works. Purport. The completely bewildered material civilization is wrongly directed towards the fulfillment of desires in sense gratification. In such civilization, in all spheres of life, the ultimate end is sense gratification. In politics, social service, altruism, philanthropy, and ultimately in religion, or even in salvation, the very same tint of sense gratification is ever increasingly predominant. In the political field, the leaders of men fight with one another to fulfill their personal sense gratification. The voters adore the so-called leaders only when they promise sense gratification. As soon as the voters are dissatisfied in their own sense gratification, they dethrone the leaders. The leaders must always disappoint the voters by not satisfying their senses. The same is applicable in all other fields. No one is serious about the problems of life. Even those who are on the path of salvation desire to become one with the absolute truth and desire to commit spiritual suicide for sense gratification. But the Bhagavatam says that one should not live for sense gratification. One should satisfy the senses only in so much as required for self-preservation. One should satisfy the senses only in so much as required for self-preservation and not for sense gratification. Because the body is made of senses which also require a certain amount of satisfaction, there are regulative directions for satisfaction of such senses. But the senses are not meant for unrestricted enjoyment. For example, marriage or the combination of a man with a woman is necessary for progeny, but it is not meant for sense enjoyment. In the absence of voluntary restraint, there is propaganda for family planning, but foolish men do not know that family planning is automatically executed as soon as there is search after the absolute truth. Seekers of the absolute truth are never allured by unnecessary engagements in sense gratification because the serious students seeking the absolute truth are always overwhelmed with the work of researching the truth. In every sphere of life, therefore, the ultimate end must be seeking after the absolute truth, and that sort of engagement will make one happy because he will be less engaged in varieties of sense gratification. And what that absolute truth is explained as follows. So there is a sense of self-preservation, and also the senses, everyone has different senses, and the needs of the senses are not neglected, of course, in devotional service. But there's a way in which if you try to be overly austere in your sense gratification, there's a rebounder effect where you might, you know, restrict your senses and then artificially, and then they will come back even stronger later on. So there's a natural way to control the senses, which is to be more and more engaged in devotional service and to live specifically, to do things specifically for the purpose of remembering Krishna and to increase your service. For instance, you know, everyone has to work to live, especially nowadays. It's kind of a cruel society. It's not like, you know, we live in communal situations generally where, you know, the people who have a little bit more take care of those who have a little less. Everyone works together. But it's sort of... people live in a lot of isolation these days. Satyadev, I've mentioned this before, our good friend Satyadev worked as a paramedic for many years, and he said he used to frequently get calls in San Francisco from people who would dial 911 emergency, and he would go there on the call and would find an old person that was so lonely that he or she couldn't take it another second. So they'd call for, they were going to die out of loneliness. It's a horrible thing. People have to work hard, too, in order to maintain a certain standard of life, and that's very difficult also in many cases. So in that sense, you know, there is sort of a hard struggle for existence, and there is a way that you have to find a balance in order to take care of yourself and to have some sort of balance in life. So that's not as easy as it might have used to be in a more agrarian kind of situation, where you're living more close to the land, etc. You have a little more of an artificial situation these days. But my main point is that everyone has to find and adjust their life so that they have enough sense gratification. Sense gratification is like salt. You know, you don't want too much, you don't want too little. It's like when you clip your fingernails. You don't want to leave them too long, and if you cut them too short, you're going to really hurt too. So you have to be careful how you do it. There's a balance there. And one person's food is another person's poison. So each person has to adjust accordingly, according to their lifestyle. One person is living in a renounced style of life, and it feels good to that person. Another person, if they tried that, they'd be very uncomfortable. Someone was just telling me that a friend of theirs, a devotee friend, came to India for the first time. For some people come to India, come to Vrindavan and come to the Dham, and they immediately want to turn around and go home. Did you know that? Yeah, sometimes. Because it doesn't appeal to their senses. And so, you know, they get a little bit intimidated by the whole environment. You like it? Yeah. Oh. Well, it could go either way. I like it. It appeals to me. But other people I know have come, you know, and it doesn't. It can happen in any environment. In any case, this devotee, who is a writer, and he's spent his whole life in New York City. He's used to the New York City environment. And he came to Vrindavan and felt like he got sick, and he thought he was going to die or something like that. And this other devotee, he said, "Don't worry, I don't think you're going to die because you're not advanced enough to die in the Dham." And he was greatly relieved. He said, "Oh, okay, good." But for him to say, "Well, I'm going to stay in India, you know, I'll tough it out here, you know, because I'll make advancement," or something like that, it wouldn't be practical. And everyone has a way in which they have a practical way of balancing their life and doing service and remembering Krishna in a practical way. This is really what Varnashram is about. Varna and ashram means that everyone has a certain psychophysiological nature according to their birth into the modes of material nature. And according to that, there's a way to be comfortable and be productive naturally. And so if society is arranged to accommodate everybody so that they can naturally satisfy whatever sense needs they have. Hare Krishna, so happy to see you. Hare Krishna. Welcome. We're so happy you're here. Hare Krishna. Then you can perform, you can live naturally in a balanced way with the sense gratification that you need. Like an elephant. An elephant eats tons every day, practically. I rented an elephant once, and I saw that. In South India, I was with another devotee, and we rented an elephant for a few days. And we went to a few villages. It was huge. You'd get an elephant. Because you go around, and when you have an elephant, everyone comes running out to see the elephant. We'd go through these villages riding on the elephant, and thousands of people would come out offering him sugar cane and every kind of thing, and then we'd get down and we'd distribute books. It's how to get everyone to come out of the village all at once, you know, just riding on an elephant. But we had to transport her to different places on a truck. We had this big old truck. We put her in the truck. And then we'd stop every once in a while. They had some food for her, you know, but we'd stop in a place where there was a lot of trees and stuff, and the elephant caretaker would get out and chop down these huge branches, and she'd be back there just eating them all. She just ate all day long. So that's her sense need, you know. She needs a certain number of branches to eat every day. Somebody else needs just a little bit. Same thing with human beings. We all have certain kind of, our senses are aligned in a certain way. So we have to have a balanced life, a healthy life, according to our senses, so that we can then think about Krishna and use the balance of our time for Krishna consciousness. And then it's successful. It's practical. Rakshit Prabhu.
Another question.
question which came up in an earlier discussion about karma and also the fact that according to one's karma, one is going to get what is due, and also that Krishna is providing. So in that context, the question that comes up is, what is the role of one's endeavor? Because you were saying, well, one really doesn't need to endeavor much because what one is going to get is decided by karma. Krishna is also providing.
May I amend that?
Yeah.
One doesn't need to over-endeavor.
Over-endeavor.
There is an endeavor, though, because even though there are, you know, the prime necessities of life are provided naturally, even the birds and squirrels and everything have to do a little work to get them. And for human beings, there's a way in which, if you get a seed, you get a package of seeds. Anybody who's gardened knows, does any gardening knows that there's an inordinate amount of food that comes out of a small plot of land. I mean, I have a small garden and a few garden boxes where I grow vegetables, and when I put in a few seeds, I can't keep up with how many zucchini and tomatoes and everything come out of that. Really, there's an arrangement within nature to give us an abundance of things. Of course, I do have to go out and plant the seed. And if you want to make advancement in anything, you have to put a little work into it, no doubt about it. But over-endeavor means that now I'm going to figure out how to make a huge profit off of this. And a part of the starvation and the problems in the world come from an artificial kind of standard like this, because you get profit takers rather than those who are looking towards the welfare of their citizens and stuff. There's a situation in Zimbabwe right now, which Jimmy Carter just said was, I forget the word he used, but he said it was beyond deplorable. The citizens are starving and they're in a really dire situation over there. And that's because you have a leader who's a despot. And he doesn't care about anything except his own power and aggrandizement. And therefore, the citizens suffer. This happens from time to time. Things come out of balance. So Krishna says, Paritranaya sadunam vinashaya chaduskritam. There's a battle raging in the material world where there's good and evil. And Krishna comes to even the score. So those who are working for good, for spreading Krishna consciousness, you know, have to give people knowledge and an opportunity to have a Krishna-conscious lifestyle. So there is a mission, and there is a progress to be made, and to help people, to help themselves, and so on and so forth. And that's the idea that those who are spreading Krishna consciousness have, or should have. So far, we've talked about a little bit from the Sri Ishopanishad. We chanted the Ishopanishad, and we looked at the 17th verse about how, let this temporary body be burnt to ashes, let the air of life be merged with the totality of air. And we got into a discussion about renunciation, or a feeling of detachment from the world because it's not a stable place. And we talked a little bit about why bad things happen to good people. It's an ongoing discussion. And how about if we look at the Bhagavad Gita?